Hello. For this Yuletide episode of Airs for Architecture, I spoke with Petra Marco, architect and director of Marco and Placemakers, a placemaking and urban strategy company in London and Bratislava, creative director of visual design studio Milk, and most recently, director of the Metropolitan Institute of Bratislava. Petra and I spoke about her recent publication, Meanwhile City, a guide on how temporary interventions help make place.
Airs for Architecture, a podcast about architecture, buildings, urban culture and space.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Airs for Architecture. I'm talking today to Petra Marco in Bratislava. Petra, would you be so kind as to introduce yourself, please?
Hi, Ambrose. Really happy to be here and to chat to you today. Thanks for the invite. My name is Petra Marco. I'm a co-founder of Marco and Placemakers, and I'm also, as of lately, the last 2 years, collaborating with a visual design studio, Milk, who are based in Bratislava. And Marco and Placemakers was set up and is operating in London since 2013. And we also opened a branch in Bratislava, hence all of this sort of reshuffle geographically. But I'm sort of working and living in between London and Bratislava, but based in Bratislava these days. And my work is all about placemaking, urban design, and thinking about all the spaces in between buildings and how we can make cities more livable. So it's all about cycling, encouraging cycling, walking, inclusive public spaces, and so on.
So that's wonderful. Thank you. I encountered you through social media. I can't remember whether it was Instagram, Twitter, or LinkedIn. Probably Instagram. I'm guessing.
I didn't use Twitter, so probably.
Oh, right, Twitter.
Yeah, I've sort of given up on it. I used it for a few years, and then I was just, you know, this is too much. I just focus on the channels where I feel like, you know, I can engage.
Yeah, I think describing Twitter as too much is probably the right way of doing it, is too much. But anyway, and I saw this publication, this book, Meanwhile City, how temporary interventions create welcoming places with a strong identity. And I've been involved in Meanwhile projects myself, perhaps in a less considered way, perhaps in a less conscious way. So I was immediately intrigued, and I wanted to, speak to an expert about it. But I just thought I'd come back to this idea of you being in Bratislava. When we look at pictures of Bratislava, Slovakia, and online, it doesn't seem like the kind of place that placemaking is required. Does that make sense? Like, it's like a historical, beautiful, somewhat old kind of thing. Isn't placemaking what you do in kind of suburban developments that don't have any sense of place?
No, we do it all over the place. So basically the reason why we set up a branch of Marco and Placemakers here is that over the last 6-7 years we were more and more carving out work in this part of the world, in Central Europe. And I mean, I'm trying to think how to put this in a very short way rather than talking about it for an hour. But basically since the change, since 1989, Velvet Revolution, the sort of post-socialist countries and, you know, former Czechoslovakia, had a very dynamic evolution in terms of city making, because on one hand, there were a lot of strategic sites and land sold off to private hands with very little conditions attached often. And then on the other hand, the cities didn't have enough money to maintain, you know, public spaces and big public buildings. So some of these very, very big monumental modernist and sort of post-Second World War era buildings, which had been built during the communist regime as sort of, very representative, big buildings, which also reflected the regime. They have a very difficult evolution and you know, how people accept them now, 30 plus years on, and how can they be transformed an edge to the city rather than being some of them sort of, you know, the white elephant in the room or you know, empty buildings. So there were lots of things. And also we've got a whole era of, you know, the sort of 70s building of the housing blocks, the sort of panel blocks. So Bratislava has the largest panel block suburb, which houses around 100,000 people, just across the river from the historic town center. As you mentioned, you know, there is the picturesque, the castle on a hill, the historic town center, the city on the river, but then there's also the suburbs. And then also there is a trend, which is not a very good trend for, in terms of urbanism, lots of new housing, as in single family houses being built on the outskirts and further away from Bratislava, all these satellites, which don't have a lot of amenities and services and which are very car dependent. Mm. So on a daily basis, you know, this is the problem of Bratislava. We've got lots of traffic coming in on a daily basis, in and out of the city, people living outside. There's more growth of population on the outskirts of Bratislava than in the city. So the challenge is really to focus on the compact city, to focus the growth in the city or within the city boundaries, to have walkable city, the 15-minute city, short distances, services, amenities. So a lot of our work, the placemaking work, for both private and public sector, is about setting the long-term principles, how either brownfield sites within the city or, you know, existing buildings or public spaces, how can they transform in the long term, and how do they need to adapt in light of climate emergency, in light of, you know, rising inequality in terms of access to housing, services, you know, inclusive public spaces and so on. So this is a topic which has been really more perceived by developers in the last 5 to 10 years, I would say, as an important topic. Before, the development was quite uncontrolled. As I mentioned, the city didn't have a big say in some of the strategic sites because they were sold off with no conditions attached, which has created a big tension between the public sector, developers and the general public and the city hall. And our role is not just thinking about how these places could look and feel like in terms of placemaking, urban design and architecture, but it's been very much about being the mediators and facilitators between these different stakeholders and often conflicting interests, because, you know, transforming the city or shaping the city is a very complex process. And what I mentioned, all this sort of baggage and all this transformation of you know, former Czechoslovakia in terms of the geopolitics and so on. And now also being so close and on the cusp of this this rising kind of far right in Europe that we see. We are next to Ukraine and you know, people really have mobilized here to help the Ukrainians. We've got a big influx of people from Ukraine, which is very welcome for Slovakia, because we are a very small country and we are in need of people with all levels of skill and knowledge to come in and get involved in work and in building the cities.
Thank you. I was wondering, maybe we could go back to just this word placemaking. Can you help me understand it a little bit better? And because I think it's quite, perhaps to the outsider or to the interested person, but perhaps someone not involved in placemaking, it's a bit of a nebulous concept or vague.
So for me, placemaking is about interventions of any scale, from acupuncture all the way to master planning, which are enabling people to build a relationship to the place. So it's about really understanding the meaning of the place. Whenever we do a project, it's never on a green meadow, so to say. There's always some history, there's always some character, there's always a community or communities. And then there's also the future users who will come and visitors and so on. And I think maybe I can illustrate it with a little anecdote or a story, something that happened or that I did some 14 years ago. I visited Havana and I was there for an urban design charrette. We were looking at the future of the harbor in Havana. And there is Malecón, which is an 8-kilometer seawall promenade, which is sort of, really a barrier for the very, very open sea waves. But at the same time, it is a public space next to a four-lane road with no trees, no benches, and it's really crowded on a day-to-day basis, not just weekends. It's really the most popular public space in Cuba, and this is the place from where the Cubans watch the horizon, and some have obviously tried to also flee in boats from this place. And it is a place which really represents freedom, or the idea of freedom for the Cubans. And I think it was really an important lesson for me back then, when I was really in my journey towards becoming a placemaker, if you like. I trained as an architect, and it made me realize that it's really important to be sensitive to these hidden meanings and the identity of a place and what it represents, because sometimes the physical form, you can have beautifully designed public realm, and nobody's there, and sometimes there are other factors, other stories and meanings and symbols of identity and character, and we should embrace those. So I think when we are talking about placemaking, it's about understanding both the physical space and the hidden stories behind it, because everybody forms a relationship to the place or to the city through their experiences, and it's very individual. So, I mean, for me, my relationship to London is very much formed by the people that I meet, the places that I go to, and everybody has this mental map of their city, and they can be very different. So we need to, as placemakers, we need to be also conscious that, what is maybe a really great space for somebody might also have a negative effect on other parts of population or other groups of people. And I'm sort of alluding to the phenomenon of gentrification, which is something that we need to be aware of when we're dealing with transformation of cities.
Yeah, for sure. And gentrification is an interesting one, isn't it? And a big topic in its own right, one I'm not entirely, haven't got my head around entirely at the moment. But I very much like this idea of the placemaker as the mediator. Now, we will get to talking about Meanwhile City and Meanwhile Projects, but I'm very interested about in this idea of what a placemaker does, because from what you're saying, it sounds like they are an in a way, an organizer of relationships rather than what we might see as a traditional designer who sits down, thinks about the site, thinks about, bit of history, bit of context, bit of climate, little bit of precedent probably drawn from. Instead, what we have here is someone who, I mean, how do, I guess the simple question is, how do you do it? What is
Well,
involved in this mediation?
I'm glad you mentioned the sort of relationships, and orchestrator of relationships sounds almost a little bit like social engineering. But what we do, but what we do, and I hope it is not enforced, but it's more organic or natural, is that we always collaborate. So we are always part of a bigger interdisciplinary team. We very often, on the big master plans I mentioned, we're working on a big master plan in Prague, for instance, 24 hectare area next to the historic city center, which has so many barriers, the two railway lines cutting through. It's got a major flyover road, sort of motorway, the central bus station, and so on. And so we are part of a larger team. We're working with two lead architects in this case, and our role there is about helping the master planning architects and the architects and others in the team really to think about how the relationships in this area, in this really big zone of the city, could work on a day-to-day basis. How do you, we often work with the idea of characters and future users and existing users and their daily rhythm. And so this helps us really to set the principles for the area. So how can we ensure that people can get within, let's say, 15 minutes walking or cycling to the places of work and get about their daily business? How do we ensure that there are active frontages so that people are encouraged to walk even in the evening when it's dark and so on? How do we orchestrate a series of public spaces? Because it's not just sometimes it's not about one big sort of landmark public space, but it's about an interlinked network. So we work very much with streetscapes as well as public spaces and how they are interlinked. And you can even then go into opening up courtyards of buildings and how do you work with the different zones of privacy and openness? Because yes, we want all public spaces to be inclusive and open to everybody, but then if you have a residential courtyard, there's also an element of a sort of semi private or semi-public space, if you like, a space where the occupants might, have to feel safe to leave their children to play in and supervise and so on. So it's a lot about this independent mobility of children as well when we are thinking about those public spaces. So yes, so it's literally about how does this life evolve in between those buildings and what is the hierarchy of those spaces and how can we accommodate the different needs of the different users? Because you will have tourists, but then you will have locals and the residents. And Prague, particularly, is a city which is very exposed to tourism. It has been a little bit calmed down by COVID, but I mean London as well. I'm currently sitting on the design review panel for Westminster Council, which was just launched this week, actually. I was there 2 days ago. And this is a big challenge for Westminster. I mean, it's the premier sort of tourist destination globally, and it's the center of London. It's the home to Hyde Park and Buckingham Palace, and at the same time, it's home to many, many thousands of local residents who have also then very different needs. So it's about, as you said, thinking about these different needs and relationships and how can those different demands be kind of met, not in every space. So it's not talking about, everything needs to be for everybody and everything needs to meet all those needs. It's about creating an interlinked like an organism, if you like, which has these different aspects, and then some of those places are where everybody meets, like at King's Cross in London. You've got the Granary Square, and this is a place where really everybody meets. From 2-year-olds, children up to elderly people playing chess under the trees. So I think this is the beauty of our placemaking. It's so diverse and multi-layered.
You find that the same principles of placemaking come up? So obviously when you're doing placemaking in Prague, big tourist city, capital city, or you've got London where, the rules of engagement are different in these spaces insofar as there's just a hell of a lot of people. And so the principle of if you build it, they will come. You could put Granary Square anywhere in London. There's just lots of people. So you're going to get, you need less than 1/100 of 1% of the population to be passing by it, and you've got a massive population, just a big numbers thing, isn't it? But if you were to do it in some kind of regional town, some kind of out of the way, there must be a very different game at play, much more, much, and then also you're dealing in London with, it's the richest place in Britain. It soaks up all Britain's money, and turns it into, I don't know, chief executives' bonuses, as far as I can see, and nice pavements. Whereas when you're in the regions where all the other stuff happens,
Yeah.
it's a different game. Do you have experience? I mean, you obviously have experience within that realm as well.
Yes. Yeah. I do. I mean, One project that I've been part of since 2017 is Velocity, which is, contrary to the title, actually looking at the future of the countryside and sustainable growth in the countryside. And so this is actually a team of six women that we got together to do the Oxford-Cambridge competition led by National Infrastructure Commission in the UK. And it was an ideas competition, you know, how can we accommodate 1 million new people in Oxford-Cambridge corridor by 2050? And we thought, you know, instead of looking at cities, which we completely agree that needs to densify, you know, the cities across the corridor, Oxford, Cambridge, Milton Keynes, we thought, you know, nobody's really tackling what's happening in the countryside and the car dependency and the elderly population, people being isolated, mental health issues, lack of services, you know, pubs, schools closing down. When we went there and looked around some of the villages, in some villages people were apologizing there were no children in that particular village because it was simply unaffordable for young families to move in. So Velocity is a strategy which sort of looks at all of these aspects in places which don't have that density of population that you talk about in the big cities where, you know, if you do it, they will come. It's actually the opposite challenge. It's like, you know, how can you actually incentivize people? Because during COVID, I mean, it really, the Velocity project was, we started in 2017, but then, you know, during COVID, it became even more relevant because actually there's a lot of work that can happen in the countryside, particularly, for instance, women are very active who are based in the countryside, setting up new businesses during maternity leave and so on. So there's a lot of entrepreneurship that can be at a small scale, which can be encouraged, and it requires good Wi-Fi connectivity, good digital connectivity, but also it requires not just the digital networks, but also the physical networks, the physical support networks. And so our strategy with Velocity was looking at how a cluster of villages, because we found that, you know, generally speaking, the villages are within a couple of miles of each other, and then you can, you know, walk or cycle in between them fairly easily. There's gravel paths between them, which can be opened up. And also, once you look at it as a cluster, they can offer all of the services and amenities that you need on a daily basis. We're not saying you should never go to Oxford or Cambridge and so on. And the whole strategy was also about linking it with the new with a planned railway line in between those cities, so you could cycle to the railway station and have this modal, multimodal commuting. So you take your bike on the train, or, you know, leave it at the station and so on. But it was all about saying, you know, one village might have the Saturday market, another village might have the GP surgery, another one might have the secondary school or the primary school, and as a cluster they support each other. And if you one of the main topics was also, you know, where is the housing? Because the new housing that is being built in the countryside and in more rural areas, generally speaking, any larger scale development is happening on a green field, detached from the existing community. There's new infrastructure that needs to be built of roads, utilities, etc., which is very costly. So we were saying, you know, we could look at densifying villages within their remit, and you can do it with the local people. You can do it through local plans and through consensus, and that's where, you know, people were even saying when we went to some of the villages, we'd like our children to be able to move back, but they just can't afford it. So we would welcome development. So you know, looking at how do you approach this NIMBYism, because these areas, some of these villages are dying, and I think it's really a problem. Also, it's a problem in terms of biodiversity and so on, and we could be talking about this. I could talk about this project for ages, but yes, it's also about thinking about a network, a physical network, and a network of people, and then about the incentives and the building blocks that you need to put in place to encourage sort of sustainable communities and growth in rural areas, which are respecting the character of the rural architectural sort of architecture and landscape, but at the same time, they are actually creating those hubs of opportunities also for work, for leisure, and so on, and so that people on a daily basis don't have to get in a car to go into the nearest city.
Yeah. That's excellent. Thank you. I'm interested in this idea of densification, which I'm a little more, I suppose, skeptical about than perhaps others might be. I when I was training in architecture in the late 90s, early 2000s, it was all about the dense city, and I think that's been very good for land values. I would just I so the land holders, who tend not to be ordinary Joes, have done very well out of narratives around the necessity of densification and rural densification or suburban densification. I'm sure the land is owned by the same people. So I'm a little bit suspicious, particularly that Oxford Corridor project. I'm guessing that hedge funders own the land, and they've been leveraging discourse around sustainability to their advantage for quite a long time.
Well, I have to say actually that we, it's really hard because of the land ownership. It's really hard to make it happen. And actually the big barriers are also like nobody, house builders, they don't want to be building on five or six individual small sites. They want to be building on one big site. I mean, in terms of the logistics, the velocity strategy that we've developed is seen as very sustainable in terms of the growth in placemaking and communities, but it's also seen as a complication and not as straightforward in terms of the delivery, but also the sustainable aspect of delivery from our point of view was that it can provide jobs locally to smaller contractors rather than having, these large frameworks with these really big house builders doing, 200 or 300 units on a greenfield somewhere where they have to build all the roads and so on. Having a series of small contractors based locally, using local sourcing materials locally and so on, but the logistics and the relationship, managing the relationships and implementing that is a lot more complex. But I think it's the nature of the game in climate emergency that we just have to really start and come up with solutions. How do we go on about making these more complex, enabling these more complex delivery mechanisms, which are in the long term much more sustainable for the economy as well?
Sustainable economies, the oxymoron to end all oxymorons. Sustainable economics. And I could talk about that for a while, but instead I want to, so this idea of small scale that you've touched on here is very interesting, and I think it's a nice segue into the idea of talking about meanwhile cities, which is the publication itself is lovely, beautifully produced, and very elegant, as I would expect. I like this idea, as I said in my comments to you yesterday, I like this idea of meanwhile city. So obviously we think more in terms of meanwhile projects, which is to say little discrete sites that a thing is done on. And as I understood it, certainly from my work up in Glasgow previously and elsewhere, this is about sort of occupying a site in a way as a form of kind of peri-security for the landholders before they build something permanent or a building. But a meanwhile city, that's a completely different game. Can perhaps you can introduce this idea and unpack it a little bit.
Well, actually, as you mentioned, there were in one of the presentations that I did about the book, there was a really good discussion about this topic of meanwhile city, like, as in, is the city meanwhile actually, like, the city is always in evolution and in transformation, and meanwhile projects and temporary interventions, I mean, some meanwhile projects last for years. So, when does it become a permanent project, and when is it called a meanwhile project? And what most of the people that we interviewed about the different case studies that we had in the book have said that the meanwhile projects that they were involved in had stayed longer than they had planned or anticipated, and in a positive way. So I would say that whenever somebody is starting a meanwhile project, they could expect it to last a lot longer than they were initially thinking. And our big focus in the way that we had selected also the case studies was to look at meanwhile projects and temporary interventions which had impact on long term for the city or the place. So even if the project or the initiative did not stay on the ground, it had a specific impact, either in terms of change of behavior of people. So this is talking about a lot of the green mobility initiatives when we're talking about, you know, pop-up cycle lanes and school streets initiatives, which are very popular in Hackney, in London. And but they've been, you know, they started to be implemented all around the world, really, you know, closing the streets in front of the schools during the drop-off and pick-up time. And this sort of gives space over to the children and parents. There's more opportunity for parents to socialize. There's safe space to for children to play. And it encourages more people to come to school by bike or walking. So there's the behavior change aspect, which is important with those temporary trials. And then when you mentioned empty buildings or empty plots of land, it's about also oftentimes informing the future use by doing some tests on sites. And I really like particularly the structural initiatives where it's not just one-off, but for instance, I mean, in London, there's so many examples of buildings that were repurposed temporarily, like Peckham Levels, you know, it's the workspaces and ateliers. It's also one of the case studies. But there's an interesting one in Rotterdam, which there's a public-private partnership. So it's an NGO or SCAR who, together in partnership with the city, have taken on a portfolio of around 40 buildings in Rotterdam, and buildings that are owned by the city, but the city doesn't have the resources or the money to make them operational. So they are effectively unused assets in the city, and some of them might be redeveloped in the future and demolished, redeveloped. Some of them might go through more extensive refurbishment, but at the time, there's just nothing that the city can do with them. So SCAR is kind of repurposing these buildings into different uses. So the one that we've got in the book is has become a fashion hub. It's called the Vasserai, and it's a former laundry building.
I'm glad you pronounced that, but and I didn't.
And what's nice about it is that it's not just, you know, this sort of quirky creative hub where the fashion shows happen and the ateliers are, but it's also the place where the garments are made. It provides workshops, upskilling workshops for people locally. It provides jobs locally, so all the seamstresses are there in the building. So I think this is looking at these structural initiatives is really interesting. I mean, you could, in terms of sustainable mobility, we can look at the Barcelona Superblocks, which is essentially closing off streets within this rigid grid of Barcelona and making them into kind of, you know, temporary plazas. It's been shown that it's good for business. You know, there's more footfall, more people on bikes who tend to stop much easier than if you're in a car. So the local shops get more custom, but also in the long term, a series of these temporarily pedestrianized junctions form a network. And there's also the greening aspect. So there's more greenery introduced in these junctions, more seating possibilities. And in a city like Barcelona with the climate adaptation, this is also vital because we need more greenery anywhere we can get it. And once you connect the green grid of the city, this becomes a really big structural tool. So what starts as a small kind of acupunctural intervention can become a powerful structural tool, in this case, for cooling the climate, for strengthening community relationships locally, for supporting independent shops and retail. And yeah, I could go on about many other case studies.
Yeah, I mean, it's the book has got some wonderful case studies, a couple of which you've mentioned there, described and illustrated very beautifully. I am interested in a little comment that you just made there. You know, you talked about sort of changing behavior. Is this the kind of Is the point of meanwhile projects, as you describe them, a way of demonstrating existing need and values, or is it about producing new ways of engaging with public space? I mean, it's probably a bit of both, and this will come on to we'll come on to in a second, which is the question around who is doing this, who needs to be involved for a meanwhile project. But I guess, yeah, to go back to that first one, like, is that the goal? Is it to make people, to induce people, so we say, not coerce, but to kind of entice them into kind of changing the way that they operate in the city?
Yeah, I think absolutely. You sort of answered it yourself that it's a bit of both. And I think coming back to the placemaking point, if we think about meanwhile uses and temporary interventions as one of the tools for us as placemakers, then they are about enabling the relationship to place to form. And so I see a lot of these meanwhile projects are those opportunities for people to either rediscover their neighborhood, their street, or to engage with a space that they haven't been going to or that have been inaccessible previously. I mean, obviously, a lot is happening in terms of new big regeneration projects like King's Cross or even up in Manchester.
Even in Manchester, heaven forfend.
Where it's perhaps where it's led by developers, where meanwhile is brought in as a tool to really put the area on the map. So it's
Yeah.
about starting to do an activity in a space that had been previously abandoned or closed off. If you think about King's Cross, I mean, opinions differ, but the actual site where King's Cross development is built now had been closed off. It's been in the ownership of the railways, so you could think of it as a part of the city which wasn't really on the map very much. So meanwhile, uses and interventions had been used over the 20 years that the development was under construction in various ways to engage different kinds of communities and to really say, look, there's this new part of the city that we're building. We want you to be part of it, and here is what you know we are offering, but also we are interested and curious what you think could be here. And I think the case of Skip Garden, which had been the first, very first part of a temporary community garden on site, which had moved around as the development was built out. And the fact that last year the developer had given an area, a site on the estate for 999 years to the Story Garden, which it is now called. So the Skip Garden became the Story Garden. So the Story Garden is now effectively going to be at King's Cross for the next 999 years. I think that's a nice story of you know the power of meanwhile and how it actually becomes also permanent. But the
This
idea.
idea of sort of prototyping ideas in space, seeing what sticks, in a way, kind of replicating organic urban change.
Yes, absolutely. But it, you know, you always need some ingredients, and King's Cross were very lucky having gotten you know Central Saint Martins in, and having also those I think 20 historic buildings which are retained on site. So you know there are elements of deep elements of character in terms of the architecture, but there are also elements of identity in terms of who are the occupants and the mix of uses on site. But back to your point about behavior change, I think it's perhaps a nice to mention Grätzl-Oase in Vienna, which is a city-led initiative, and it's providing organizational and financial support to residents to build parklets or spaces for children on their street. And this is a really interesting initiative. They've supported over 500 projects in 4 years' time, and it's important that it's in a way it's a top-down meeting bottom-up. So it's a city-led program, but people are actually building the parklets, and they get up to 4,000 euros per project. I think this is really also coming to your next point about you know who gets engaged and who do you need to make these things happen? I think that we cannot expect residents on a daily basis to sort of like put in huge amounts of time in and money, which equals money in a way, to co-creating their city. But if we put the right incentives and tools and structures in place, we can really encourage that. So what Grazia Oase is doing is saying that apply with a project that you'd like to create on your street. We'll give you up to 4,000 euros if you are selected. We give you support in terms of the process, so you don't have to worry about taking up parking spaces, because at the moment, for instance, in Bratislava, if you wanted to make a parklet on your street, you would not know where to start, because if you would put it on a parking spot, then it would be towed away. And I think this was the case also across the UK when this sort of guerrilla gardening started during COVID. There were lots of things happening that people were out of their own initiative making these parklets or spaces outside of on their doorstep, because people wanted to be outdoors and they couldn't move around as freely as before. And then some of them had to be taken away by the council, because maybe even the council would not want to take them away, but in terms of the process and the regulation, it wasn't allowed. So Grazia Oase takes away all this organizational hurdle. So you can do it. You can take up parking spaces. You can add, you know, you add more greenery. You have to live very near, or you know, right next door where you want to do your project. That's another condition. It can't be anything commercial, so you can't sell anything there. So the aim is, and what the organizer said is that the beautiful thing about it is that people really get so much joy out of making something happen in a very short space of time, and then seeing also how it impacts on their neighbors and on mm-hmm. the street. And you know, not everybody has the time to get involved in making this, but then there would be the people who apply and make it, and then there would be the people on the street who and the neighbors who will also use it, and that also creates new opportunities for socializing. And maybe there's an elderly person or people in the building who maybe will take joy in watering the plants. So it also fosters this sense of stewardship, which is important. It in a way like really illustrates this point about building relationship to place, and having a relationship to place is also about having responsibility for it. So you then really take care of it, and you take pride in it. And I think this is at a large scale what placemaking is about in cities, where we don't want the city to be consumed. We want it to be co-created as much as possible, as far as possible. And I think that's where also the Junges Grazia, so the Grazia Oase initiative part, which focuses on young people and children. Schools can take part, individuals or families or children, and the point is that they make the project with the kids. So it's about giving agency to the youngest residents as well.
Excellent. It's a really interesting one. This idea of co-producing these things and utilizing community energy, or instrumentalizing it, or instigating it, supporting it, by making infrastructure which makes community engagement more likely to occur or more likely to happen is quite an interesting one. But how do we measure it? Because you're talking here about complex socio-cultural, psychological, spiritual kind of metrics, which is a great deal of trouble when you're also, on the other hand, having to deal with basically quantitative assessment, like how many cars go down this street, and how many people live in this city, and how much excrement do they produce a day, and how many trees are there, and so on and so forth. So you've got this kind of city making as a technical exercise about counting and quantification. And then you've got this idea of placemaking, which is ephemeral and mysterious in a way. So how do we assess? Because, so from my experience, one of the things about these activities of pop-ups and meanwhile and so on is that there's very much a kind of self-reinforcing assertion that it's a good thing because it's a good thing. And I think where, from my perspective, where a lot of this kind of participatory work struggles is that There is no established way of assessing its efficacy like there is in any other serious enterprise. And yet, what we're doing in all of this stuff, city making, is the most expensive thing that humans do, like by many factors. I mean, it makes biomedical research look like a drop in the ocean compared with how much money, Bloomberg just
Yeah.
spent £1 billion on one building in central London. We're talking such staggering sums of money. And yet we have this apparatus, meanwhile use, pop-ups, participatory practice, co-design, co-production. It's got millions of names. And nobody has written the rules of assessment. So I was
Yes.
wondering, how do you go about as part of Milk, as Marco and Placemakers, how do you understand the value of assessment, of measurement, and how do you do it?
This is a really important point, and I mean, the answers are, I think, shaping on the way because data is becoming increasingly important, and it is also in terms of getting support for these initiatives, you have to speak the language of the decision makers, and if we are talking about politicians, then the numbers are needed, and as you mentioned, it is sometimes really difficult to quantify the value of placemaking or the value of manual activation. And but I think it is starting to become part more structural part of projects, even larger scale regeneration projects. And part of the mechanism is social value being introduced in the planning system in the UK. So major developments or any most developments nowadays through Section 106 and community infrastructure levy, they also have to declare the social value. So, I mean, just because of the sheer size and length of King's Cross as a development, they're probably a good case study in terms of measuring because they had really put a lot of effort into mapping the effectiveness and the effect of what they have been doing in terms of the meanwhile activation on the estate. So visitor numbers, how many people were engaged in various workshops. I mean, there was the temporary construction skills center, which I think over 5,000 people were trained got training into the construction sector. Wherever it's possible to collect data, I mean, even the skip guard, how many workshops they ran, how many children, etc., were engaged, wherever possible to get the numbers. I mean, another good example is the transformation of New York City during Bloomberg's tenure, actually, as you mentioned, Bloomberg, when Janet Sadik Khan was the transport commissioner, and all of those major pedestrianizations of Times Square and hundreds of kilometers of cycle paths were implemented, and data was crucial for them when they did the temporary trial of pedestrianizing Times Square, which I think they used like 374 beach chairs initially, just as a pop-up. Then they measured the data around in the surrounding road network and how it had adjusted, and they were able to say that actually traffic was smoother. There wasn't a significant rise in congestion or number of vehicles, and in fact there was good there were good indicators for the businesses on Times Square for the retail and shops, etc. I mean, obviously when you have like thousands of people on a daily basis hanging around there and with the possibility to sit down rather than just running in between cars, then they also spend more. So I think those two large scale examples are good examples how it's important, and it's important to evaluate. Another point you made was, by default we all just want to say, these are great things and great initiatives, and shouldn't you just love it? And it's for sure positive, but it's important to evaluate. And I think what happened, I don't have a specific example, but what happened at King's Cross is that every year they evaluate their program of events, and this includes temporary pop-ups and so on. And they evaluate it, and then they decide, was did this really have an impact? So are we going to move on with it? And what was also a good point from their sort of their team was that just because something had not had the most number of people attend is not the exact measure of impact, because some things are just for a niche of people. So some things are for teenagers and skateboarders, and you don't expect, you know, people of all ages to be there in great numbers. But if it had actually engaged that skateboarder community to a significant degree, then you have actually met that goal of reaching out to that community, and as you know, then other specific activities. Mm-hmm. So with Milk and the fact that basically Milk approached me last year in 2022 in the spring, they said, you know, we are a visual design and communication studio. We work with a lot of developers, and they want us to come up with a naming for the project. They want us to come up with a narrative and all this supports the sort of communication and about the future development. But what we really want to influence through communication as well is that we don't talk about the future, which is a visualization. We actually talk about what's happening right now. So if you're talking about sites that are awaiting development, there's a lot that can be done in the meantime, which actually gives genuine content, authentic content to communicate, rather than saying, like, you know, in 15 years time there'll be a lovely development here with a playground for kids. I mean, at the moment, you know, if there's somebody with a 3-year-old at that stage, you know, that child is going to be 18 by the time the development is done. So there's no value for that person to engage in that conversation. So so they said, you know, you've been in London for ages, and there was a lot of this happening, and obviously in a very, very, in a city which is exposed to all these global forces, and as you mentioned, you know, a lot of capital coming in, a lot of contesting interests as well, but actually a lot has been happening in 2008 when the financial crisis came, and I think a lot of the meanwhile projects in London also had started initially quite, I think some of them as a very sort of commercial kind of intentions, and or extremely bottom up. So there were these two sides, and I think now over the 15 years or so, I think actually there's more understanding of both the social and economic value of or commercial value of those projects. And I think, you know, we can't shy away from those words when we are talking about making a regeneration development work. But I think that those interests, which were perhaps more opposing at the beginning when meanwhile started to be used, are actually more coming together, and there's more understanding of the finer grain of what meanwhile can be. I mean, Janka Tein in London does a lot of work with on housing estates with communities using meanwhile as an engagement process and a tool. So this is coming to the point about, instead of showing some visualizations of what the future regeneration project will be like, engage the community through co-creating, building a place, and then also how they want to use it and what are the needs that they have will come out of that process, come out of that very direct engagement process.
That makes sense. I guess for me, there is this other aspect which is a little bit more complex to measure, and perhaps we could talk about this another time, because I think, well, for a start, we're coming to the end of our time, but this idea of measuring these ephemeral values like empowerment, care, community, which are assumed to be the upshot of social engagement, but aren't always, something that I come back to quite frequently in my thinking and my research with mental health care professionals is the effect on the most vulnerable of activities. These activities can produce heightened inequality, peculiarly enough, if someone is already quite socially engaged in their community and they engage in social engagement activities through meanwhile use or participation of some form, then they might gain, say, two measures of psycho-cultural good. but someone who is marginalized already might only gain one measure. And therefore, what you've achieved is precisely the opposite of what you intended, which is that the marginalized person becomes more marginalized. So I'm kind of very interested in this. And I think I've seen this myself in projects that I've worked on, projects that I've produced, where you get a certain form of engagement, which is very dynamic and fantastic. And then you get the quiet people who never turn up. And you're never going to get them in. But perhaps this is unfair insofar as this is one tool in a full armory of one weapon in a full armory of weapons that could be utilized to engage people. But anyway, as I said, I don't think we should get into that. I like it. I think it's a really great book and wonderful projects. I'm interested in this idea of how you would use this perhaps within an education setting. How might you, should we teach placemaking of this kind to students, and how might we go about doing it?
I think it is already happening, certainly at some schools of architecture. I mean, I was teaching at the London School of Architecture, and there's a whole cities module and think tanks, which were very much about really looking at some big challenges and topics for London. I mean, the London School of Architecture always sort of takes this lens of looking at a particular area mm-hmm. of London, because the students are immersed in the city, and it's also the thinking that, you know, we should be working on an area that we are able to go to and to really spend a good amount of time in. So I think it is that many schools, even when I'm called to do crits at different architecture schools, it is definitely part of the curriculum, whether more or less explicit. It's definitely a topic that certainly younger generation of students are very aware of. I think also the sort of response or engagement we got about Meanwhile City Book is a testament, I think, that the industry, from local authorities and developers through to business improvement districts or citizens initiatives. We've had, when we launched the book in October, we had, initially we had an open call where people could request a free copy, a hard copy of the book. And in 2 or 3 days, we had over 500 requests, and they were as diverse as I mentioned. So really even local authorities, and I've done a number of talks for local authorities who are struggling with the process. They really are actually welcoming the tool, but they are mainly the question in the question time, it comes to, you know, how do we actually embed it in the planning process? How do we enable more meanwhile projects to happen smoothly? Like at the moment, you know, quite often the hurdles that you have to go through, particularly if you are dealing with a meanwhile project which is also partly in the space of the street and the road network, then it is often quite convoluted and not as straightforward. It could be as difficult as getting planning permission for a permanent building. So on one hand, it's a quick way to test things, but sometimes with the regulations and planning mechanisms in place, it is a challenge. So also many of the clients behind Meanwhile projects said that, you know, this was really a value that they had decided that this is what they really want to do, and they've gone over and above to achieve that. And I think the more and more case studies we have and the more it is talked about, and also hopefully our book helps with communicating that in an engaging way. And this is where the collaboration with MIL was fantastic, because I mean, I'm an architect, placemaker by background, and I have written before Meanwhile City. I've written, you know, I write for journals and so on. But what I was able to do with the help of having a really great editor and then having an illustrator, making the topic really accessible and without dumbing down the subject, I think was really well achieved. It's playful, but actually saying, look, meanwhile projects are here, they've been around for a while, and they should be taken really seriously as very powerful tools by both local authorities, developers, citizens initiatives, and even residents. And And I think it's a matter of time when they become more embedded in legislation and regulations, and it's a matter of time when at architecture schools maybe there's a, I mean, a couple of months ago, I think Gove, didn't he announce a new architecture school of sorts that he wanted to set up? It was called, it was some, well, it was related to the beauty report, which you're aware of. I think it didn't really get a lot of traction because it was basically saying that there should be a separate new school which is going to teach placemaking to all these students who are at these other architecture schools, and it seemed really disconnected. So I think it's something, it's a topic that needs to be embedded in architecture education, the same way as I think kind of entrepreneurship and business thinking should be embedded in architecture schools. So I think architecture is becoming or has been becoming a really rich field. It's always been a very rich field, but architects had a lot more power at some point in the history. And then there was a period where, you know, our role has been really limited, more and more limited. Also, you know, with the construction contracts, design and build, etc., you know, getting the architect out of the way as soon as possible, just getting the concept and so on. And I think architects since 2008, in my opinion, since the economic crisis, have been looking at ways to be more entrepreneurial, to be their own clients, oftentimes to try, even sometimes go to become architect developers, to initiate projects, to educate the clients in the process. And so I think this is a really exciting time for us because of the challenges that we have, particularly with climate emergency, to really come up with all the tools that we can master to work collaboratively and interdisciplinarily to address these. So I think that we can do it.
Fantastic. Thank you, Petra. It was wonderful to hear you talk, and a lovely publication, which I shall have all my students read. So thank you so much for joining me.
Brilliant. Thank you.
All good. Thanks to Petra Marco for taking the time to talk. Thanks for the book also. There are links to it and to Petra's various companies and online presences in the podcast description. Thanks for listening.